Today we're talking with Dr. Carl Warner, author of the forthcoming book, Living Fossils. Carl, please educate us a little bit on living fossils. What are they and how do they impact science?
Well, in 1938, the first living fossil was found. It was a fish that was a fossil that looked exactly like a living fish. It was called a coelacanth. And the problem with living fossils for the theory of evolution is evolution says everything changed over time. But here you have a fossil of an animal that looks exactly the same today as it did back during the time of the dinosaurs. And it just makes you question the whole theory of evolution. Hey, why did this animal not change? I thought evolution said animals changed. And living fossils were more of an enigma or just kind of a rare thing in the past. We were always taught in college in the late 70s and 1980s that, oh, you know, there's just a few of these and none of them are the same species. But it turns out that there are living fossils of all the phylums of animals that are living today found with the dinosaur, and they look exactly the same as today's forms.
Oh, exactly the same. That's amazing.
Uh-huh.
Well, in your book, Living Fossils, you write about having visited scores of museums around the world and photographed tens of thousands of fossils. How did you gain access to all these dig sites and museums? What credentials generated, you know, being taken seriously by your inquiries?
You know, I had been frustrated with the topic of evolution since 1979 when I was challenged by a college classmate. And I worked on that for a number of years, I think 18 years, just by reading books, and just got utterly frustrated. Finally, I talked my wife into a plan where we would film a documentary for one of the national television networks, either PBS or Discovery or Learning Channel. And we'd do this on our own and then submit it to them and do a series on evolution. At that time, the idea was not to have us in the show, but it was just more or less to be a scientific show about evolution. Is there any problems, etc. So we formed a television production company in 1997. We bought, you know, tons of equipment and just went out to these dig sites and started filming. They were very cordial about it, and they took us in for these interviews.
So they just welcomed you, and with the credibility of doing a documentary, then you could just go on site and film them.
Yep.
In this process, then you talked with leading scientists on both sides, I presume, of the evolution versus creation science debate. How did you determine who to interview and who not to interview?
Well, I didn't want to waste the viewer's time, nor did I want to waste my time. So we only sought the best of the best of the best. We sought after National Geographic scientists. We sought after, you know, PhDs only, authors of books, and we just picked the top books on evolution, the evolution of birds, the evolution of dinosaurs, the evolution of pterosaurs, and just interviewed these top scientists. And then we did the same thing with creation scientists, although we had more problems interviewing the creation scientists, getting access to them. We interviewed Dr. Gish at the Institute of Creation Research. Again, someone with the credentials, a PhD, and you know, these are the people want to hear from. They want to hear someone in the know who actually knows the data, the facts, you know, the proofs or disproofs.
So all of the interviews and the interview snippets that appear in the book, these are all, world-class leading scientists.
World-class, you know, nobody on either side would doubt the credentials of any of the scientists that we interviewed. I mean, you see the scientists that we interviewed, you also see them on other documentaries on National Geographic or PBS, whatever. No one could ever question the credentials of the people we interviewed. We interviewed the president of the Paleontological Society for the United States. So, you know, just the top dog, so to speak.
That gives a lot of credibility, I'm sure, to the book. In chapter 3, which is called The Naming Game, you explain the difficulties between naming modern animals and plants compared with fossils. Because of your research, has there been any improvement or any closer alignment in naming fossils and modern animals and plants?
Well, here, this is probably the most interesting chapter of this book, Living Fossils. And this is why everybody missed the fact that there were all these modern animals with dinosaurs, because they were all renamed. In other words, you have a scallop, a common scallop shellfish.
Mm-hmm.
So if you find the exact same organism in a fossil, in a dinosaur layer, they wouldn't call it a scallop. They would call it a different genus, a different species. And this is why most people miss this, that all the animals were the same, but they were assigned different species names. This took a while for me to sort out, because I would photograph a shrimp, say, at Solnhofen, Germany, where Archaeopteryx was found, and they would say, oh no, this is not a modern shrimp, this is this genus and species, you know, I won't give you the name. And then I went home and took out a shrimp and photographed it and placed it side by side, and we're like, this is nothing different, this is the same animal. And, you know, at first I thought it was, just an enigma or just an exception to the rule. But then, as we went on from group to group to group to group, you know, the sponges, the corals, the echinoderms, the arthropods, the mammals, the flowering plants, all the same, but they always get a different name by the evolution scientist who discovers the fossil. And so it creates the illusion of change, the illusion of evolution. You could never figure this out on your own. You'd actually have to physically go, like we did, go to the museums, photograph them, come home, get these photographs, take them out. You couldn't go by an article about these fossils. You have to put them side by side with the modern organism. Once you do, you realize, oh my, everything looks the same. You know, it's the most incredible thing I've ever experienced.
Hmm. So you really conducted a lot of original research.
Oh my. You wouldn't believe the amount of data in my, office here. For example, we 60,000. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
I'm sorry. For example, we have 60,000. Let me start this over. The amount of data that we collected to analyze was astounding. For example, we took 60,000 photographs of fossils. And we had, transcripts, thousands of pages of transcripts, and then the video shots at the dig sites, all just to give us enough information to judge evolution or not. It was a very arduous, enormous task, but, you know, it turned out to be well worth it once we put it together for a Living Fossils book.
So because of all this research you did that was brand new research, has the scientific community in general, have they changed the way that they classify fossils?
Well, to be honest, the book hasn't come out yet. I'm just waiting for the fireworks to start.
Oh, good.
Because nobody has ever challenged the naming of fossils. And basically this book is a huge challenge. Why do you call this, sand dollar a different genus and species when it looks exactly the same? It's an affront to the paleontologists who name these fossils, and I'm sure that they're going to have some criticisms back, but I'm just waiting for the fireworks to start March 2nd when the book comes out.
Very good. Very good. Well, out of that 60,000 photographs you took, you have more than 700 in the book. How do you think the book will be used in classrooms and by homeschoolers? Is there a teacher's guide that will go along with it?
Yep. And I wrote the teacher's guide. I thought that I needed to do it as a scientist. You know, I got my degree in biology. So each of these questions that I wrote for homeschoolers and high schools and, 7th grade up, college level students are laid out in the book, the homeschool / educator's guide, or called the teacher's manual, and you can use the book as a 1-year long course or a 6-month course along with the teacher's manual and have an excellent time trying to analyze the theory of evolution.
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you, Dr. Carl Werner, for your time today. Dr. Werner's book, Living Fossils, Volume 2 of the Evolution, the Grand Experiment series, will be available online and in bookstores in March 2009. And you can learn more about Dr. Werner's research and this entire project on his blog at tangle.com/evolution, the Grand Experiment. Thank you, Dr. Carl.
There's no spaces in the Evolution, the Grand Experiment. Just tangle.com/evolution, the Grand Experiment, no spaces.
That's correct. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.